Hello, everybody. I'm John Atack, and I'm very pleased to see Dr. Stephen Moffick again. Hi, Stephen. How are you
Hello,
doing?
everybody. John.
Yeah. And you sent me a piece that you'd written for Psychiatry Times, suggesting that it's a good idea for us to write our eulogies while we still got a chance and assess our lives in that way. Would you like to open that topic out a little for us?
No, I don't know how much I want to open it, but I will. you know, when you think of doing your own eulogy, you're thinking about your own impending death, right? Although I think it could be started and done anytime in life, you know, when you're 15 years old or 30 or whatever. The genesis for me came in two different ways. I first did an initial one almost a decade ago. And my son's a rabbi, and occasionally we have this discussion and a little bit of disagreement about eulogies, you know. So for most religions, at least Christianity and Judaism, a clergy member does a eulogy for somebody, or and family members do it after they die. And it's generally also positive. Sounds wonderful. Person sounds wonderful. I joke with my son, well, I get the leftovers from your eulogy. There's some angry family members, disappointed in the person who died and so forth. So it makes them feel good temporarily. But if there's been an ambivalent relationship or not a good relationship, there's fallout from it. And that could lead to, and we were just touching on this before we went on the air, a prolonged grief disorder, which we can get back to. But you know, for me personally, so about 10 years ago, I was asked to write for a new blog called Over 65, meaning the blogs were written by psychiatrists over 65. It was for the Hastings Institute, most well-known ethics think tank in the United States. Mm. So a friend and colleague of mine started this, and he asked me to be a blogger, and that got me thinking more of what's happening. I was just over 65, and so I thought this might be a nice trial to do my own eulogy. If I don't like generally how eulogies are done, then I should say and do something different, right? So I did one. It wasn't too long. It seemed to be met really positively, and I think somewhere in this eulogy, which I still have, and it's online. The blog is defunct now, but they saved the whole archives because they thought it was important. So I kept it around in case I die, and I told my kids and my wife. They sort of forgot I told them that there's a eulogy out there that I wrote. You know, it's like they don't want to think about that. And so it's been hanging in the background for these 10 years or so. Recently, I was asked to write a chapter on death and dying for a book on social psychiatry by Oxford University Press. I didn't want to do this, and I was surprised that I was asked, but I was asked, can you do a chapter on death and dying from a social psychiatry perspective? I said, okay, I don't know so much about it, but I'll try. And I did it, and then the eulogy, my own eulogy, came back into mind. And this year I've had more medical concerns, apparently avoided sudden death just by serendipity, something. And that also contributed. So recently with this new procedure coming up, I said, okay, I better revise this now. But the revision went from a few paragraphs to, I don't know where I'm at now, 3,000 or 4,000 words, you know, and it's probably more a summary of my life than a traditional eulogy, but I meant it to be a eulogy, and I meant it not to replace what might be done traditionally, but to be my what I wanted to leave behind in a summary kind of way. So, and it, supposedly it'll be posted on Psychiatric Times online, and probably in written form too, maybe in the not so distant future. I sent it to the editors and they didn't gasp in horror. How could you do this? You know, but so it's coming.
Excellent. Years and years ago, about 40 years ago, I remember reading an article where somebody had proposed or was actually using a therapy system where what they did was they had somebody sit down who was distressed, and they'd say, what would you like to have done with your life? When your life is through, what would you like to have done? Write down as if you'd achieved all of the things you want to achieve. And they found, curiously enough, that this had a beneficial effect for some people, which I can well imagine, because we can so easily lose sight of where we're going, you know.
I agree completely. It felt therapeutic, actually, to me. There's a therapeutic technique with older people called reminiscent therapy or something like that, and it does exactly what you said. And here's another serendipity. The other day, my wife and I went to a thrift store, and I was just gazing at the books, and I see this book called The Good Life by Dr. Robert Wallinger, a psychiatrist, and his colleague. What it is their summary, 2023, it just came out, their summary of their Harvard research study, which started in 1939, the longest research study about people's lives, circumscribed, it was people from Harvard at the time, and also poor people. But they've carried this on since 1939, also did in-depth interviews periodically and so forth. So they've got a cross-sectional and longitudinal viewpoint. And the participants actually found it was more or less therapeutic along the way. It got them thinking about their own lives when they were asked questions, you know, about how they were doing, how's your relationships, and actually relationships came up clearly number one in importance. Yeah. You know, that good relationships clearly are the biggest contributor to health and happiness for most everybody. So there's all kinds of ways to look at how important it is to do this kind of internal searching. You know, it doesn't have to be in the depth that we do in psychotherapy of depth psychotherapy, but still introspection about yourself. It doesn't have to be about yourself. I mean, you could ask other people too to contribute their ideas about your life. So.
Well, I mean, Scientology maintains a variety of websites attacking me that I will put forward as my eulogy. All the dreadful things that John didn't actually do, but that we accuse him of, you know, something like that. They've called me a drug dealer, heroin addict, a rapist. I've attempted murder, and I'm a child molester, according to these various things. So that would be one possible source for eulogies, but probably not actually my preferred source when I think about it. I was interested in
another point. Yeah, you want to clarify what's wrong out there, right? That's not facts. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've had an interesting month, you know, since we last talked, because I've been reading everything I can get my hands on about Charles Manson, and it won't be a eulogy that I write, I don't think.
Really, really.
Impossible to find anything nice to say about the man, I'm afraid. Returning to the idea of long-term grief, you tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, normal grieving, I mean, grief is potentially important for everybody in the world, right? Because everybody loses important people, and there's cultural variations about how different cultures deal with losses. What I know best is in the United States, and we don't do too well with grief. We don't do too well with talking about death and dying, you know, prepare for that. And whatever research is out there says periodic thinking about death, your own death and dying, is actually helpful in approaching your death. It helps make you less anxious. In Judaism, we have a built-in way to do that at least once a year. If you're religiously oriented as a Jew, you don't have to be. Jews are a people besides being a religion. But anyways, that's Yom Kippur holiday, the High Holy Day. And it's built in for you to really think about what you want to do better in the upcoming year, because you want to be put in, quote, the book of life. So you think about how you want to improve. So that helps. It was right after the pandemic started, the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, decided to add a new diagnosis. You know, this wasn't done because of the pandemic. It was another one of those serendipities. Right after the pandemic started, this was ready to be put as an official diagnosis, called prolonged grief disorder. And it met with a lot of criticism, you know, like, you psychiatrists are adding another diagnosis for something that happens to everybody, like grief, and, you know, we don't like it, blah, blah, blah. But anyways, it got approved in 2021. And now studies are emerging about it. And so what recently came out is a study mainly of women. I think it was 1,000 women. And it came out to show that most of the people interviewed felt their grief was going fine. But when they were asked about things that indicated maybe they weren't doing fine, like yearning so much for the a person who had died, not functioning well, those sorts of criteria, they weren't doing so well. And these are people whose losses may have been up to 10 years prior. This is a long time now. So you could say that was abnormal grief. Most people think grief should be over, say, in a year. You know, you should sort of be back to some sort of normal life. That isn't necessarily even true, because it varies with everybody.
Of course.
Prolonged grief goes further. It's like, if you're still having these symptoms after a year, it's worth thinking about and maybe doing something about it. And there's even specialized therapies that have developed to help prolong grief. So it's lurking there. 30% of the people studied, mainly white women, had criteria for prolonged grief disorder. The worst could be anticipated, the loss of a child, the loss of a spouse. Up there was loss by also violence, like killings and overdoses. Those maybe existed in 50% of the people who were thought to have prolonged grief. And, you know, the important part about it is to let the public know about this, you know, so that they may be aware they're not doing as well as they think they are, and their functioning isn't what it could be. You know, but that's challenging in itself. You know, how do you let the people know without upsetting them more?
Yeah. I'm a big fan of 6 Feet Under, the HBO series, because I've seen it 7 times. There are 5 seasons.
Wow.
All the way through,
because
when it was first on, I re-recorded it and rewatched it each week, because it's brilliant storytelling. But it's Alan Ball who made American Beauty. But it was really interesting, because it made me think about death. You know, here was this thing about a funeral home, and with all sorts of themes going through it. I mean, it was one of the first serious pieces. I think you had Will and Grace first, which was about a gay couple or gay men. And one of the lead characters in 6 Feet Under, David Michael C. Hall, is gay. But because they had to, you know, every week they had to come up with, it starts always with a death. And so they had to find different and more amusing ways of killing people off. And apparently there was a queue of people wanting to be the victim of this in 6 Feet Under, you know, over the seasons. So, you know, have a guy who goes out to talk in the garden on his phone, and he's hit by blue ice from a plane, you know, and you're expecting it to be the person inside the house who's, you know, they have a woman who's gone partying because she's finally got her divorce, and she's, oh no, let's not get into this, is too gruesome. My favorite was some guys who've blown up some sex dolls with helium, and they come loose from the top of their car while they're
Oh.
driving along, and this woman sees them and goes, "It's the rapture, it's the rapture," and walks out into the road in front of a car.
Oh my.
But it was good because it made me go, there, I don't need to be frightened of this. You know, and there's so much, you know, and so there are so many ideas, Becker and people like this, that death is the fundamental fear that we are going to have somewhere, as Woody
It's
Allen said.
unpredictable and unpredictable, you know, unless, you know, you decide to die by suicide, right? Otherwise, it's unpredictable, and it can happen in any way, including the bizarre ways you just mentioned. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, and peculiarly in my culture, the idea is that you could get run over by a bus tomorrow. That's the expression that's used,
Yeah.
and you know, it won't necessarily. It could be an elephant dropping from the sky. You know, it's so hard to tell, but we, you know, one of the things that came out in that, one of the embalmer, Federico, his wife's mother dies. And she just falls further and further into depression. She wants to take the children to sit at her mother's grave every weekend, you know, and just sits there and mopes. And it opens up this idea that once some sort, you know, significant attachment we have is violated.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's lost his wife and one of his children. And he is, you know, he is grief-stricken and has been for years, a very brilliant man. But so trying to find some philosophy, something to hang on to. I had 40 years believing in enlightenment, you know, that I was 17 and I met this Buddhist notion of enlightenment, and it seemed, you know, that would be the vital thing in life, that one should become enlightened. And so that was essential to my thinking. And then about 15 years ago, it suddenly it evaporated, and I had a complete change of heart, because I realized that what I wanted from enlightenment was a serenity and equanimity that could not be upset in any way, and that was fear on my part. It wasn't really a positive thing, and I stopped believing in it as a concept. I've yet to meet anybody that I would consider enlightened. Obviously, Stephen, you come very close, you know, but
Oh, I have problems with that conception too. In fact, when I was studying the Enlightenment Age with somebody, I thought it was problematic because it left out the emotional stuff you're mentioning, you know. And so if you just rely on rational thinking, you're missing a lot, including what we just talked about, grieving. But yeah, you're missing fears, you're missing all the emotions. The task is to combine, you know, enlightenment with emotions, or thinking with emotions, not separate them.
Yeah, or not think they can be separated, you know,
Yeah.
that yeah, it's so true. But I came to you know, what you said earlier, which is that what was significant in life is relationship. That accepting that there will be times when I feel traumatized. There will be things that will overwhelm me. There's pain, there's, you know, all sorts of horrible things can happen. Though the Buddhist notion that everything is suffering, I think, is a little oversimplified. I think
Yeah.
there's a great deal of joy in life as well. And I'm, you know, I'm not trying to end, you know, get off the wheel of suffering or any of that anymore. By making strong relationships and by being a good friend, by being dependable and trustworthy, and having compassion towards others, we, you know, that's who we are. That's, you know, and I guess that's your subject, isn't it? Social psychiatry, how we relate to each other. Our mental health is so dependent upon relationship and how we get on with others. At the worst, you know, being in an abusive relationship where somebody's gaslighting you and triangulating you and doing all sorts of horrible things. that's destructive to self-esteem to such an extent, and I've of course have dealt with a lot of people this has been done to, that people lose themselves in the mix. They want other people to tell them who they are. The most famous one in former cult circles is somebody leaves an authoritarian cult and you go to a restaurant with them and they pick the menu up and they say to you, what would I like? You know, they are so used to the locus of control being outside of themselves. And to get into a situation where, you know, I feel so incredibly blessed because I have so many close friends, people I've known, you know, some of them for a short time, but many people for a very long time now, for decades, who I know I can absolutely depend on because I've been able to depend on them. So if they're feeling low and having a problem in life, you know, I'm there for them and the other way around. And to me, that it's that interrelationship that we are threads in the tapestry, that we're part of, you know, something larger, that, you know, so pursuing individual enlightenment somehow becomes a selfish act, or can be seen in that way.
And you've mentioned and clarifying something really important in relationships, underline the word good, you know, because as you mentioned, relationships can be bad. And you're a more of expert in the cultish kind of bad relationships than I am. But I remember a colleague at the medical school where I worked and gave me this warning. Enemies will stab you in the back. Friends will stab you in the stomach. So be more concerned about your so-called friends in an academic institution. And I think he was correct. You know, you have to, like you mentioned, you have to prove that the relationship is mutually good and that you've still maintained your own personality and identity within the relationship, and actually that you help each other grow, not become stagnant and serve some ulterior purpose. So it has to be good relationships.
Absolutely. I mean, some significant time ago now, as I tried to pull away from being, you know, a critic of Scientology, because they harass the hell out of you. You know, they really do. It comes every day. You get lawsuits, private detectives, rumor campaigns, you know, all sorts of horrible things. As I tried to pull away from that, I found myself in a collision because they have a harassment department. They seek to influence people. In 1993, the head of their investigation unit turned. She came to get me, to have one last stab at me. And during our conversation, she broke. She just realized what an awful life she had. And so she told me that there were four people who were actually feeding her information about me, one of whom was my driver. And so I came away from that, and they'd also managed to influence my friend network so that I was attacked. I was very seriously attacked by people that I loved and believed in. And, you know, which resolved itself. You know, I'm okay with that. I understand what happened to turn people against me. And I understand that much of what was said was, in fact, not true. It was very distressing to be attacked by these people. But underneath that, there were the relationships I had with my family, particularly with my mother, two of my brothers and my nephew. And that allowed me to get through. And it brought me to this, you know, realization that there are these people, you know, our mutual friend, Steve Hassan, for example. We first met in 1989. And although there is a perennial attack upon Steve, which we won't get into, and which he doesn't get into, he tries to ignore it as best he can. I've never known him do anything that was disloyal, or, you know, he's always been absolutely trustworthy. and we are the best of friends. And thankfully, that's the situation for me with a number of people. It does make it easier when you don't have an intelligence agency pursuing you, I must say. Scientology seems to be more busy with people more celebrated than I am, thankfully. And they're not my major topic. I just keep wandering back to it because it exemplifies so much of how we should not behave towards one another.
You know, the other thing you mentioned, which I think is so important about all this, is how you describe recovering and the role of other people, because you don't want to go through this stuff, especially the kind of stuff you went through and Steve went through. But in the best of all worlds, you can come out more resilient and stronger in many ways and have a kind of renewed vision of life. You know, we use this term in psychiatry, maybe for the last 5-10 years, of post-traumatic growth, post-traumatic stress. So you can come out of this improved and better. That's not to say I would recommend it going through this to anybody, but there's also ways to come out positively from having to go through whatever major traumas have happened to you. And friends and family are key to that.
Absolutely, yeah. I had a period where I was looking after my aging and wonderful mother, who lived to be 94 years old, where I found myself quite isolated. She died in 2011. And it was interesting to reconnect with the world, having been so involved in that, having despaired of the ex-Scientology community, which offered me no support of any kind, because I think, I dealt with about 500 people directly in their recovery, sometimes just, for an hour or so, sometimes, in one case, for 35 years, to the point where somebody was able to think about it for themselves. You know, it's not necessarily an elaborate process. And as I became more familiar with it, it took me 7 years from 83 to 1990 to be able to sit down with somebody who believed in all of this and give them another choice, give them information that they most definitely didn't have, which I'd been digging out from under the rocks where L. Ron Hubbard had left it. And to get into that conversation, which is never a conversation that's about reasoning. You don't logic somebody out of a belief. You have to give them the power to logic themselves out of the belief. And to do that, you have to, be in an emotional situation where it's safe for them, it's all right for them, rather than the usual parental response to somebody joining a group is, how could you be so stupid? Which really doesn't help,
No, makes it worse.
Creating an environment where, about 500 people over the years had come through my doors, and I wasn't charging any money to do it. People had heard about me. They'd come and talk, and I'd, do what I could to help them. And it was fascinating watching how hard people will hold on to a dogma, a doctrine. Once we believe something, some people talk about first impressions.
Certainty. Most everybody likes certainty. And so you grab onto certainty, even if it's not certain, if it's not the truth.
It's surely what demagogues and populist leaders are offering.
Right.
And, from Hitler through to more contemporary individuals, that this idea that they know what they're doing and they can tell us what to do. And Hitler's a very good example, because he was not a clever man. He was a man who had a few simple ideas, and yet academics and intellectuals, 45% of German doctors joined the Nazi party.
Yes.
And so to see this, which of course Robert J. Lifton in the Nazi Doctor 6 has explained in great detail, bless him, remarkable man.
Yes.
But to see this exactly what you say, the demand for certainty, the wanting to understand and feeling inadequate in our own certainty, feeling that we don't understand. And some strong, usually man, there have been a few strong women in history, like Catherine the Great, Indira Gandhi, you know. But some strong man usually will come along and say, this is the truth. If we just, get rid of all of the Romanies, if we just get rid of all the Jews, if we just get rid of all the white people, if we just, whichever section of society is going to be the target, then everything will be fine if we just get rid of these people. And watching, because my work has been with fanatics, it's been with people who believe things very deeply. And to get somebody to reorient their thinking so that they're not under the power of this pseudo certainty, this pretense of certainty. I always use the same example. I've been doing it for decades. When I was 17, I spent a couple of hours on the street. A born again Christian was talking to me, and I think I was perfectly friendly, but he wasn't getting the response he wanted. At the end of a couple of hours, he backed away from me and he said, I don't understand the Bible, but I know it's all true. And this is William James's noesis. This is this the feelings of certainty, the feelings of knowing with which we live and with which we have to live. But I think this too, that something about our emotions becomes almost dogmatic, that we feel a certain way. And so when somebody gets stuck in grief, that it's the tram lines are laid down. This is how the behavior will be. And I think it does become, I think it's a really good thing that's been recognized as a condition that has a negative effect upon our mental health, and is something we can do something about by, in the one way, giving people something positive to do and saying, what do you like doing? Go and do that. If you like swimming, if you like the movies, please do give some part of your life to that. Follow your bliss, as Joseph Campbell put it. But also some portion to reflection. And for me, it's more kind of memorializing somebody. Proust said, when somebody you love dies, you place a cutting in your heart, to grow from there. And I've been very fortunate, with the loss of both of my parents. Certainly with my mother at 94, she was done. Again, the cliche, the trope in this country is she had a good innings, good cricket metaphor there for you. But I was surprised at my response because, as I say, I'd looked after, in fact, the last 17 years of her life, I was around. And the last 5 years was fairly intense because four of her vertebrae collapsed and she was in pain. And when she died, I started thinking about this when I was about 20. What am I going to do when my mum dies? I love my mum. It's sort of not, no Oedipus stuff going on there, I hope, but not that I ever noticed. But when the time actually did come, 30 something years later, it was a relief. And when I think back to the time we spent together, I there's a certain there's still a sense of loss. Of course there will be, but it makes me smile to think about her. I still have the cutlery, some of the cutlery and crockery that she used, and I'm happy that that's an integral part of my life. And again, it's what I've said about being a thread in the tapestry, that I accept that she lives through me, and that we keep on passing this on as we go along. And for the most part, that resolved. It was a good thing, as you say. If somebody loses a child, that's what I'm not sure about. I wouldn't. I'm not sure anybody can cope with that. But it is a matter of then going. In my case, I've got four children. if I lost one of them, I've got three others that I've still got to be there for. And that's, you know, got to be integral to my life.
Yeah. Important reason for living has to remain. Yeah. I mean, the finality of death, how people feel, of course, varies. There could be relief, like you just say. There could be great sadness, you know, all sorts of emotions. The important point is to realize them and deal with them and talk about them. You know, with this idea of certainty, part of what's behind that is a sense of safety and security. You know, we've tend to think of safety and security from a physical standpoint, but it's also psychological. And that was part of the brilliance of Abraham Maslow here, hierarchy of needs. You know, so on the bottom, he has safety and security, but it's not only physical, it's psychological too. And so if you lose somebody important, it's like your psychological moorings are taken away too. And you sort of have to try to find those in other ways. I mean, this is one thing I don't like to think about at all. Goodness knows how I would be able to cope after my wife died. I mean, we've been married 55 years now, been together 58 years or something like that. I mean, I don't know how I could cope, you know, without her, because in many ways I depend on her and vice versa. And I think my certain of my abilities have diminished as I get older, and so on. So, but it's also the safety and security that's so important. And so, for instance, you talk a lot about cults, you know, they pretend to give you that safety and security, and it's only on their terms, of course, but you know, it helps to fulfill that need easily for somebody. You know, you don't have to do much to fall into that. It strikes me that cults sort of just go up the ladder of Maslow, but they stop way before self-actualization, which is a crucial top part of his model, but they try to provide everything up to that.
So. Yeah, and the perversity is that many cults began because they were pretending to offer self-actualization. That's what happened in the late 60s, where you know, the establishment was too dangerous to fight with, and people turned inward and started going on these journeys and finding that, you know, so many groups out there are predatory, and it's about the ego of the leader. It's a, you know, who's would often probably be classifiably a malignant narcissist, you know, or, you know, but, and so they're in fact the inversion of what is good. They're the very opposite of what is going to be good for us. And you end up with, you know, Charles Manson or Jim Jones, or William Branham. I've been looking into his life recently, or is it William Dudley Pelley, the founder of the Silver Shirts, who was a kind of bizarre occultist. There are so many of these incredibly dysfunctional human beings who find themselves governing the rest of us because they offer certainty, because they offer self-actualization. But in the end, that self, you know, in Scientology, you promise self-determinism. But that self-determinism will be doing exactly what Ron Hubbard says. You know, you'll be thinking for yourself when you think as I do. You know, what a ridiculous idea. Which
I must.
The unfortunate expression Rondroid has been developed in the ex-Scientology community, but I think it probably is best not to insult people you're trying to help, so I do steer away from that one a little bit. And also, I mean, our view of death, it's a long time since I read it, but Charles Tartt's Altered States, back in the 60s, which was quite a revolutionary tome at the time. And he has I can't remember, who, you know, it's a long time, but there are a group of people who basically, when a child is born, they mourn this particular group. And, you know, it's a, traditional society. This is a long-held practice. And then when somebody dies, they rejoice because, you know, they feel that life is... So it's kind of a very literal application of the Buddhist notion of suffering. The Jains, of course, in India, for them, suicide is considered a heroic and saintly act, but it should be suicide by self-starvation, which is a very gruesome thing to do. But again, they seem to believe that the world is evil and to be escaped from, you know, that kind of Manichaean darkness. And I mean, the last couple of years I've been gradually working on a book about belief, coming from the misquotation of Voltaire, when people believe absurdities, they are prone to commit atrocities. And he didn't. As far as I can tell, he didn't actually say that. He said something much more elaborate than that. But he's often quoted as that. And I think that's a very good place to go, that our grieving and our sense of what death is to a large extent cultural. In looking at the Jewish religion, I often feel that Judaism is a lot more practical than other religions. You know, you sit Shiva, you have ways of accommodating death and of dealing with life, and without the expectation of, you know, the pearly gates and all of that stuff. It is about living a good life now, doing something now and achieving something. And I think too many religious beliefs put it off until after death. You know, then we'll get round to having a happy time or something. And I think that it's now that matters. It's what we're doing right now. This is what we have, and it is wonderful and terrible and everything we can imagine. It's all there for us. And so there's a singer called Roger Chapman who wrote a song which is the tagline is when my real life begins. And it's such an acute observation of how so many people come to live, that they're putting off and hoping that one day in the future, or one day, you know, they'll go to heaven, or their grandchildren will live in the socialist paradise, but there's nothing for them now. And I think Judaism is realistic about that.
Yeah. You sort of read my mind. What I thought was important to mention is what you just did. I mean, for certain people in certain religions, there's a certain idea of what happens after death, which can allow you to ignore things that might be important in life. And I mean, who knows, that whatever people are believing after death may be true. You know, we don't know that. And I think you're correct that Judaism is much more vague about that and puts an emphasis on life and doing good things during life for other people and the world. Now, I would hope myself there's something after death for my soul that somehow I might know that'll happen, but I have no certainty whatsoever about that. All I'm certain about is I'm living now and what I want to try to do to make my life as meaningful as possible. If something good happens afterwards, terrific, but have to wait and see or not see, right? Mm-hmm. So, but that's important to, you know, it's an important thing for us to ask with our patients, you know, what do you believe about the afterlife? You know, what's your religious background? What's meaningful for you about your religion, if you have any, or your spiritual beliefs? I mean, those are so important to understand. So,
yeah, absolutely. That in dealing with anybody, one of the things that struck me on, you know, leaving Scientology, where you're basically trying to convince people that this is the way, the truth, and the life. This is all there is. There's no other choice. And I'm afraid we see that in far too many practices. There's this elitism that you'll find in all of the religions. Have some portion of people who are saying, if you don't do what we do, then you know, you're finished.
Especially on the fundamentalists.
Yeah, the fundamentalist end of any group, whether it's the ultra-Orthodox Jews or Wahhabi, Salafi Muslims, or, you know, and some of the Shiite sects as well. And so many, you know, I've been looking at William Branham recently and talked with an expert on that, John Andrew Collins, who his grandfather was the lead preacher at the Branham Tabernacle. So he grew up within this thing. And he then went off and researched the whole of the Pentecostal movement and found that all of the founders of this movement in Christianity, which is so powerful now, they were all frauds. They were all undoubtedly frauds. That doesn't necessarily say anything about the belief of followers now. Their belief can be genuine, and I don't think they should be written off because it was a con artist who started the whole thing. But nonetheless, it gives us pause. It has to give us pause for thought. As to the afterlife, I'm agnostic. I grew up in a Christian household. At 13, I decided I didn't believe in the God they were talking about because he seemed quite unpleasant to me, and I didn't like that idea, worshipping somebody unpleasant. And I stopped really believing in a personification of God at that time. I then got into Zen Buddhism for a year, age 18, was very deeply into that. And it, as I say, that stayed with me for long beyond that. But I found that my any need for a knowledge of, you know, what happens after death or what have you just evaporated. It just went away. I think probably Chuang Tzu among the Chinese philosophers would be the place I'd go to, where he says, well, I don't know where I was before I was born, and I don't know where I go after I die. End of discussion. You know, then a year or so back, I read this incredible book. A woman called Deborah Blum, who used to be the head of the Science Writers Guild of America, I think it is, and has written she wrote a wonderful book called The Poisoner's Handbook, which is about the development of forensic science, particularly in New York from the beginning of the 20th century, which I found absolutely compelling. You know, how you could tell if somebody had been chloroformed or what have you, you know. But she also wrote a book called The Ghost Hunters. And I was amazed to find for many years, William James has been a really significant influence in my life. He was a remarkable man. And The Varieties of Religious Experiences is one of the great works, I think.
Yes, three.
I didn't know he was a founder of both the British and the American Societies for Psychical Research.
Oh, I didn't either.
And this book goes into great detail about his relationship and about some of the experiments they did. And I must say that for the first time in many years, I started going, they do seem to have found some interesting things out here. You know, that the Rhine Institute and later things I have no real interest in. But what they were poking around in at the end of the 19th century, and there was a particular thing which is quite startling, and they gathered a tremendous amount of information. And this is when somebody has the sense that somebody they love has died, and they were able to demonstrate, you know, somebody had written a letter or woken somebody else up in the middle of the night, particularly with identical twins, if one of them died. And it James, in the end, bless him, kind of went, the evidence isn't watertight. But it was nonetheless, for me, it was interesting because to have cognitive dissonance over my non-supernatural beliefs, you know, that somebody comes along and says something. And that's, you know, when our certainty is challenged, when our belief, when what we think is the truth is challenged.
Yeah. But, you know, I've had many experiences which I would call serendipitous, but two of them along the lines that I guess you remind me of, and I don't know what to make of them. You know, I'm in a way somewhat agnostic, like you mentioned, but I knew my daughter-in-law was having trouble getting pregnant, and she went, this was years back, and she went get medical service and so forth. I knew both times exactly when she got pregnant. This feeling to me, she's pregnant now. Happened twice for both of her kids. Mm-hmm. Then more recently, which you know about, I had this best friend since childhood. And since we were 7 years old. And he's been sick. He was sick for years, cardiac problems and so forth. And we were going to meet this summer. He lives in Victoria Island. We're in Milwaukee. We're going to meet this summer in Victoria Island around our 77th birthday. And his happens to be tomorrow, which I mentioned earlier when we chatted. And I had the opportunity to speak in Toronto back in October, and the border opened up then. So I knew I could get in. And I said to my wife, I said, we better go visit him now from Toronto, because I have a feeling he's not going to be alive next summer, or I'm not going to be alive, one of them. And so we went, had a glorious time together. He was in okay shape. And about a month later, on December 1st, he suddenly died in the hospital. And like, so it wasn't like an immediate, I didn't realize he was dying at that moment, that time, but I sensed something was happening and I needed to act on it. And also not have any regrets that I didn't do my best to see him before he potentially died. And if he didn't die, terrific. Then we just went, we have a good time. But I tell everybody now, you know, if you have a loved one that's sick and not nearby, go visit them. You know, you're not going to know probably when they're going to die. And you've got to take the opportunity to say goodbye in some sort of way, just in case, you know, and not live with regrets afterwards that you didn't take a chance to tell them how much you love them and what they meant to you. And if you can do that in person, that's the best of all.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And also, if there's somebody that you've fallen out with, that it's a good idea to consider patching up, you know, anything like that, so you don't have that regret later on.
Yeah, you bring up another really important topic, which is forgiveness.
Yeah.
And forgiveness is potentially, when you don't forgive, it's first of all so destructive to yourself, medically and psychologically, but it is a way to bring closure too. And you know, whether you forgive just within yourself, and I've been very involved in studying the trial of the Pittsburgh synagogue mass murderer now, you know, wondering which of the relatives can forgive or not forgive. But you know, the best is when somebody asks you to forgive them and you decide to forgive them, and then it's kind of mutual and maybe the person changes because of that. But you can also just do it yourself, you know, forgive whatever happened. That doesn't mean forgetting whatsoever. Keep it in mind. It doesn't mean justice shouldn't be served legally, but just for yourself to come to peace with that. So I think you're absolutely right to come to some sort of terms. And yeah, I personally have a couple of regrets of people who hurt me quite a bit in the workplace, especially. And they're dead. I probably missed the opportunity to contact them before they died and see if there was some sort of resolution possible, or that they were important in their own way, you know, good and bad, you know. So the kind of closure that you can get along your life, but especially at the end of your life, is really important. I love seeing people, you know, from high school that I haven't seen in 50 or 60 years. It also brings back that sort of closure and connection with your past. And I think it's really, that's why I think reunions are so potentially important to go to.
I mean, it brings to mind a wonderful documentary about Rick Hall and the Muscle Shoals studio, where more than 100 top 10 soul hits, including all of Aretha Franklin, Wilson Pickett, Percy Sledge's fantastic music. That there's this great documentary, and we'll try and find out what it is and put it in the link below, where what happened was that the Rick Hall had a band that, and they became absolutely so popular in 70s. Brown Sugar by the Rolling Stones is recorded there, and Wild Horses, Traffic, Steve Winwood recorded an album there. Paul Simon called up and said to Rick Hall, I want to record with your black band. And Rick Hall said, well, you can come and record here, but actually the band's white. Sorry.
Sounded to him like they,
they are one of the great soul funk bands. You've got them and Booker T and the MGs, and of course the Tamla Motown crew.
It's a tricky issue, by the way. You know, do you sound like you're from some other culture, and are you ripping off the other culture by being that? That's a gigantic issue nowadays. I view more as potentially respect and appreciation, but it could be something else too.
When Louis Armstrong, somebody put it to him, you know, that jazz was a black music, and he said, well, what about Bix Beiderbecke?
Yeah, you know, his song "Black and Blue," Louis Armstrong is one of the great protest songs of all time. I view it, and so I think, you know, my wife sometimes sings as part of my videos or live.
Very well indeed. Yeah.
So when we were in South Africa, I presented on the role of jazz in ending apartheid, and she sang a song. The song, she said, was Louis Armstrong's Black and Blue. And she got a great hand for it and so forth. I don't think she could easily sing that song nowadays. Like, I haven't asked her to sing it for one of my videos for Psychiatric Times that might be cross-cultural, because my concern is she'll be overly criticized because she's not black, she's not blue, she's just ripping off this song, or I'm ripping off the song. And I think that's so problematic, because for us, this was a tribute, you know, and a song that had such an important message. And so why can't a white woman sing it nowadays? You know?
Yeah. I mean, Ellington wouldn't perform Summertime or indeed anything from Porgy and Bess, because he, you know, white Jewish men had written this. And it seems, you know, I mentioned Steve Hassan earlier. He was told that he couldn't have a particular job. And I've met other people this has happened to, but because he was a white cis male. And so we have this inversion of, you know, gender hatred and racism going on at the moment. I have another friend who's a documentarian, and he says he can't get a job in mainstream TV because he's a white cis male. And over here, there is great concern about that, understandably, and there should be great concern about it. But when he turns around and says, but I'm Jewish, you know, I come from a people who are familiar with persecution. Somebody actually said to him at a TV station here, well, that makes it worse. And it's sort of, how are we going to make these categorizations? The cultural appropriation. Shouldn't the Indians be allowed to use chilies in their food because they come from Mexico? Maybe not. We should ban it. We should stop it. You know, it's like, no.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're, I don't know if we talked about this last time. I can't remember, but, you know, this issue of does it take one to know one, and can you appreciate the other person without appropriating stuff? You know, so I'm involved with editing this book on psychiatry in the Eastern traditions, religiously and spirituality. And among the editors, we've had this ongoing discussion. Who should take responsibility for what? Should only psychiatrists from Eastern religions talk about certain things? Like, how about us psychiatrists from other religions? Can we talk about our views of Eastern traditions and religions, or is that inappropriate? I think it's quite appropriate. You know, I think both sides are really important. You want other people from other, you know, religions and spirituality and political stuff. You want underdogs, people that have been suppressed, to have their opportunities, for sure, and representation, critical, absolutely critical. But that doesn't mean it's not valuable to have the other side contribute to the relationship, that we come together in certain ways instead of either the powerful are on top and there's a bottom, or the bottom gets power and wants to get rid of the other side. You know, the goal is to mutually help each other and learn from each other and benefit from each other. And we're nowhere close to that nowadays, but thankfully there is progress from those who've been oppressed. But eventually we have to come together with both sides. And I hate to use this term because I'm always blasted by it when I use it, which is reverse racism. You know, it's like, if I ever use that in certain situations, like, there's no such thing as that. You know, I don't think that's true. But what I'm, whether it's true or not, what I'm trying to say is, you know, if you've been in power before, it doesn't mean you can't become attacked by another side along the way and have that affect you adversely. You know, it can come from either side. Anybody in power can abuse another, no matter what their background is. So maybe that's not reverse racism, but potentially anybody in power can hurt somebody else. That's,
yeah, and I think the issue is in the human race is one of power. And I absolutely do not take Karl Marx's position that we should exterminate the lumpen proletariat and get rid of the bourgeoisie and what have you. I think that's, you know, on, you know, there are some very good ideas about equality in his teaching and the equality of women, though he doesn't seem to have treated his wife particularly well, but there you go. But anything that is factioneering, anything that is dividing us against each other and putting us in opposition, anything that is hate mongering, anything that is telling us that we should despise any section of the population for any reason is dangerous. I watched a documentary this week about Kanye West, who's now Ye. He's not Kanye anymore, he's Ye. And there was a clip of him on Alex Jones's InfoWars with Nick Fuentes, the white supremacist, or white nationalist, as he would call himself. And Alex Jones is saying, well, of course, we none of us like Hitler. And Kanye, or Ye, he sat there and he's got a black mesh mask over his face, so you can't make out any of his features. And he's wearing camos, you know, so it's all very militant. And he stops Alec Jones and he says, I like Hitler. And you're going, this is a black man who is actually doesn't know that that blacks were on the list alongside Jews and Romanis, that they were Untermensch, absolutely.
Yes.
And he's identifying himself, and even somebody as right-wing as Alex Jones is not going to go to that place. So seeing how the that malevolence, that sense of the other, you know, the people who must be hated. And, you know, I think we have to be very careful about that. A lot of my work in the last 10 years has been about human predators, you know, taking away anything diagnostic and just saying, look, there are people who prey upon us. And
yes,
at that point, whether they're black, white, Jewish, Chinese, whatever, becomes irrelevant. What is relevant is that there are some people who have compassion and a degree of humility, and there are people and who are willing to forgive. And as you so rightly say, and I meant to underline this when you said it, I too say, You can forgive. That doesn't mean you should forget. You should remember. You shouldn't make a point of upsetting the other person by repeating it all the time. If it's forgiven, it's forgiven. But you should know that it could happen again. This person has a tendency in that direction, may not be trusted. But to try and bring people together so that we can discuss and arrive at decisions and to not have this terrible power imbalance, which we've seen, I know you have significant expertise when it comes to the transgender community, and seeing the amount of distress in that community that is being caused firstly by people on the outside attacking them, and you know, that's awful, but then you're getting where people want to retransition and they're finding themselves attacked and in a tremendous minority. of opinion. I think we're going to have to talk about this another time, because I sense that you have a lot to tell me about it, and we've come to the end of our clinical hour, which was in fact an hour. It wasn't 50 minutes, you know. So there's something. Is there anything you'd like to say in winding the conversation up, Steve?
No, you know, I think, you know, for the world now that we're so connected, you know, by technology and so forth, this is a time of opportunity and also great risk. You know, it's that Chinese way of defining crisis, an opportunity and a risk. And, you know, are we as a people going to come up to see this as an opportunity because we're exposed to each other now, and but we've got these gigantic problems in society, some of which I call the social psychopathologies, the racism, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, cults, burnout, blah blah blah. But all these gigantic dangers, climate instability, the weather has been horrendous in almost all of the United States now, and maybe it's good in some other places. It's, you
It's
know,
been way too hot in Southern Europe.
yeah, we've got that developing and coming. You know, we got the nuclear thing that behind the times, and I'm looking forward to seeing the movie Oppenheimer soon, you know, and what he went through and paid for. You know, we've got that. We've got environmental pollution going on, and you know, so many threats to humanity that we have to work on. And you know, from the viewpoint of being a psychiatrist, to me, most of these have their psychological genesis, and we in my field have to try to help. We can't just, as important as it is to help, try to help patients and see individual patients, I think we've got another bigger role in society that we have to try to participate in. And that's, to me, part of what being a social psychiatrist is, which we talked about the first time.
I mean, on the subject of Oppenheimer, again this week, that there's a BBC documentary called The Trial of Robert Oppenheimer, which is fascinating because it is constructed from transcripts, showing, how his career was absolutely destroyed by Lewis Strauss and Edward Teller. Because he said, atom bombs are enough. We don't need a weapon of genocide, please. And, Truman threw him out and wouldn't talk to him anymore because he'd gone to his office and said, I have blood on my hands. And Truman thought, what an outrageous statement. It was me that decided to do this, not you. What a ridiculous idea. But yeah, I think that it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, that we are in, I think potentially we have the tools in the toolbox to change things, but it is going to require a radical change and a move towards, for everyone enough, so that all human life is sacrosanct, and we should be looking towards that rather than, I think the statistic on the Oppenheimer thing was that by the year 2000, the US had 70,000 nuclear weapons. Which, if you add
What are
it
you
to the.
going to do with all of them?
Yeah, now we've got to do something with them. And it's enough, I think, if you add all of the arsenals together, I read it's enough to destroy everything that lives on Earth 180 times over or something. It's just madness where the whole idea of, this kind of destroy everything in your path form of warfare, which sadly happened in Korea and in Vietnam. But of course, the Russians have done it in Syria. And now it looks as if they're going into all that war in Ukraine, that they're starting to attack the grain supplies now, and possibly cause a terrible famine throughout the world in consequence. And with Putin sort of saying, well, I'm willing to use nuclear weapons, well, why? I mean, for what is this about anymore?
And here the main leaders like President Biden and the Chinese leader leaders are probably the ones who can do something about this, but how do you make the choice? Because like back in Truman's time, was that a good choice or not? You know, did that help prevent the use of nuclear weapons later on when they used it this one time? But now what are the leaders doing or going to do about Russia? You know, your choices are so difficult because you can't experiment. You can't experiment doing something versus not doing something. And, you know, you can't apply science to your decision. You have to learn from history and so forth. But it's tenuous, very frightening what the decision might be in any direction right now as far as Ukraine goes.
Absolutely. And I think so much relies on Xi Jinping and putting all of our eggs in a basket where basically we have a dictator who can decide whether or not he's going to do something. And of course, NATO has been more and more aware of the dangers of China and the possible invasion of Taiwan. So the development of bases by China throughout the world.
We used to have this great psychiatrist, you've probably heard of Gerald Post,
who would try
to analyze political leaders and inform the government. Well, as far as I know, we don't have somebody like him, but I hope we do, or wish we would, you know.
I think a lot of it
is at least United States. You know.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is the advisors who are chosen. I was amazed that the first Democrat economist in the US to suggest that China might be a danger, that was in 1999. It was that recent. And I think to we mortal men who've not studied the magical sorcery of economics, as I think of it, that it was rather obvious that China was going to become dangerous. And if you know anything about history, knowing how the Chinese feel about, you know, what the round eyes have done to them in the past, the horrors of the 19th century for the Chinese under the British Empire, you know, Americans had a small contribution towards the end of the century, but the French, the Dutch, these awful things, which are just, because they're not in our history books. We've got the stuff about how nice we are, but the Opium Wars and the Boxer Rebellion, the deposition of the emperor, that this is so much to do with Western politics.
You remind me when my wife and I went to China on a tour 10 or 15 years ago, and one of the things the tour guide said was, how they were rescuing Tibet, that those people are animals below us. Well, that was enough of a tip off. When we came home, we told our two grandkids, I think they were 6 years old and 8 years old, you need to learn Chinese because the Chinese are going to be the most powerful country in the world someday. And if you learn Chinese, you can find a role in dealing with them perhaps, but at least it'll give you the opportunity to know the language. And so our oldest one didn't persist with learning Chinese, but our youngest one, who's now entering college, is fluent in Mandarin. And
oh, brilliant.
So it's like, okay, I don't know what her career is going to be, but at least she has the language to potentially use. So
it's going to be important how we integrate things. And one last thought, which is that, you know, I have a friend who's closely studied what's happening in Ukraine, and he's seems to have come to the conclusion that it's because the Russians are evil. And I want to, you know, underline this, that it's the governments of countries that do these things, and they're forcing this upon the Russian people. Yeah. In China, seeing, you know, the umbrella protests, and now more recently the blank paper protest, which is That's Chinese thinking for you. They've gone, I'm holding a piece of blank paper. Are you going to arrest me for that? That you've not got to forget that this is a brilliant people with a long cultural history who've largely lived at peace compared to most of the world around them for centuries. And who don't want, you know, warfare any more than we do. So there is a lot of protest in China. And my hope is that it'll be the changing of minds. I mean, the point where I parted company with Marx, I was about 15, and somebody gave me the Marx quotation, "There's no such thing as a bloodless revolution." And at that point I went, well, I'm sorry, I don't agree with that at all. And it's quite obvious looking at, you know, we don't send four-year-olds up the chimneys and down the mines anymore as they did in the 1850s. These attitudes have just changed. And I think it's by that, it's by changing attitudes, by understanding that we can hang separately or we can hang together, and that we are one species, humanity. We're Homo sapiens sapiens, that's it. And we need to look after ourselves, which also of course means looking after the planet and the rest of the environment. And on one happy note here, my wife and I were rather worried last year about the amount of bees that we were seeing, or that, you know, we weren't seeing enough bees and butterflies. I'm very happy to report that in the last month my garden is full of insects, so you know, some of which bite me, which I don't approve of, but you know, so it goes.
That's right, the good and bad. Yeah, you know, my wife and I had the same sort of revelation. We were driving in the Midwest over the last few days, and the bugs splattered on our windshield. Two summers ago, there was none. Our windshields were clean. And so we didn't really like it that they were splattering all over our windshield, but that meant they were thriving again, and that was great. So, and people in the United States are doing more, although I think the ultimate solution is China, Russia, United States, and India have to somehow get together because they're the major, those four countries, including the United States, are the major contributors to pollution, you know, so.
Yeah, and I mean, we're hearing reassuring noises coming out of Brazil now that Bolsonaro, how did Bolsonaro ever get to be president? But, you know, there are complaints still coming from the indigenous people who are saying, yeah, they're still logging. But it does sound as if Lula is going to and is working to do something there, which to the US is perhaps the most relevant thing, because the logging of the Amazon is changing the rivers in the air and means that rainfall in the US, you could well get another dust bowl because of it. That would not be a good idea.
That's right.
Well, what an immense pleasure it has been talking with you, Stephen. And
well, same for me. Yeah, very interesting.
And we'll get together in a little while again and see how people and your shirt. Somebody wants to know about your shirt in the last. So what are we wearing today?
Well, of course, you told me I could go full all out as far as dressing goes. So, you know, somebody you mentioned asked what was on my shirt last time. So this time I have two things.
Yeah.
So this t-shirt says, "Listen with your heart." And I could probably talk an hour about what that means, but basically I think listening with your heart is what I try to do in this interview. I've always tried to do in my work. Psychiatrists are supposed to listen with the third ear for stuff that's hidden. And so that's a very important concept for me living my life as a professional, but in my relationship with people. Number two, it's a white and brown hands that are crossing in the shape of a heart. And so it also refers to some of the cross-cultural things we were talking about. And then there's my own heart troubles and my fortune in not dying suddenly last year. And now I've got a pacemaker, it's called Pacey, right here.
Okay. So I'm very glad that you didn't die last year, by the way.
Thank you. And then, so I was just going to wear the t-shirt, and I said, okay, I better look a little more presentable. So I'll toss on the shirt, but still leave it open. And so this has to do with your mentioning enlightenment. So this is probably the emotional part. The shirt is the rational part. It's a Robert Graham shirt, which are quite expensive actually, but I got this at a thrift store. On the bottom of all these Robert Graham shirts is a little tag, and it says knowledge, wisdom, and truth. So you got both my rational and emotional side in the dress. You know, I try to give subliminal messages with what I wear, like the ties I wear when I do the videos for Psychiatric Times. And so I just have sort of fun with that. And some people think, oh, you're not looking professional enough, but I don't know. I'm at my age, I don't care, you know, just I'll have some, you know.
Yeah. And who wants to fit in when you can have fun, you know?
Yeah, right. So thanks for asking.
Great. Okay. Thanks so much, Stephen. We will switch off the recording and book another day, I hope.
That's right.
Thanks a lot.
All that jazz, right?
Okay. All of that jazz, yeah.
Okay. Take care, John.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon. Or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.